listening to New Layer, a design podcast with Tanner Christensen and Jasmine Friedel.
As designers progress in their career, it really feels like there's only two options for them.
Yep.
The first one is moving into people management.
Right. People management, manager, leadership. Management and leadership are different, but in this role, they're one and the same.
Right. The other option is just continuing to progress on the IC track, and that is individual contributor.
Right. And so that's the IC leader who has passed sort of a senior level and has decided not to move into management, but is still leading usually through the project work and what they ship.
Exactly. So for this episode of the podcast, what I want to dive into is some maybe misconceptions and some kind of stereotypes that fall in place for that senior IC role.
Yep.
And we see this all the time.
Yep. And I was going to add, I think why this matters now, because we generally speak to newer product designers or those who are transitioning into product design. You don't have to have your career path figured out, you know, right when you start. You don't have to have it figured out in your past 2 years, but knowing that these are both options is helpful. And then knowing what they really mean is helpful. And we're going to probably spend more time on the IC path, because I think that one's the least obvious. We've had managers since the dawn of time. This whole idea of an IC leader is a little bit new. And so I think we've interpreted it differently at different companies. And I think we've interpreted it differently as we've sort of evolved what a product designer is. And I think it's important to understand where it kind of sits today, maybe where it sat yesterday, and have an acknowledgement that this IC leader track could change over time. Because something you'll notice is, you know, hey, when you start off a career and you expect to be where the people, you know, 5-10 years ahead of you are, and then all of a sudden that whole world changes, it will change what your expectation should be too. Does that make sense? Am I rambling?
No. Can you give me a specific example of what you mean by, like, you know, if you're just starting out in your career and you have these designers above you who are exemplary in whatever ways, you know, maybe they've been doing it for 5 or plus years longer than you, and then you put in the time and it's 5 years later, what do you mean that role changes? Like, what is, define that better for us?
Well, I'll give three examples if I can remember to give all three of them. When I started graphic design in the 90s, it was like this booming industry, and you could get a job and make, like, I remember it was like you could make $65,000 a year, which was a lot at the time. And then all of a sudden things changed. The web grew up and there are no longer as many roles as graphic designers. And so that's just an expectation of the amount of opportunity that changed. Another example is, this is sort of like more of a softer skill example, but like there was some, you know, when I was coming up in my career, there was this idea where you could be a creative director, and the creative director was usually the asshole boss, who had come up and done whatever they wanted. They'd worked really hard. They were a superstar. And then they didn't actually have to be nice to the people that they worked for. They would just sort of like boss them around. And that was like, people wanted that for power, right? And now, you know, there's just things going on in our world, in our country, where we're realizing that we need to be more inclusive and we need to take care of people, because people are the things that drive your business. And so now, to be that creative director, you may have to get like more buy-in and more trust built. And so that ability to just have power in a room has kind of moved on. And I think about this sometimes. We're watching Ozark right now, and there was a moment where, you know, the FBI director comes in and she just yells at everybody. And I was like, wow, there are still some careers where you can just come in and be an absolute dick and get stuff done. But in most companies in design, you won't be able to do that anymore. And then the last one that I'm thinking through is like specifically to IC designers is, you know, when we first said, hey, you actually don't have to go into management. You can be a super senior IC and not have to lead people. The common response was like, cool, I'm going to go off in a room and design my own thing and do a big reveal. And then that'll be the next magical app or the next magical discovery. And I think that one where that has changed is the reality is maybe when there were, you know, just a handful of folks, there was the ability to give them those spaces. But now that almost every company has a principal or a lead or a staff or an almost director level or a director level IC, the expectations aren't that that's just, you know, you can go off and do your own thing. The expectations are that you need to lead. You need to lead by example. You need to collaborate. You need to execute at a higher level of craft. So those are kind of all over the place examples, but it just goes to show that over time, things around you might change. And so therefore expectations might change. So therefore the role might change.
Yeah. Okay. So if I'm understanding you correctly, over the last few years, especially, the world of being a digital designer has evolved.
So much so.
A lot.
Yeah.
And now those former personas of authority and, well, like you said, power, those have also shifted. And so we had this historical role, and I mean, it still exists, but not as commonly in the product design space. We had this role of like a creative director or this like top dog who essentially their entire role is not even to like do the creative work. It's to direct people very, very specifically. And that role has also been kind of enmeshed in this persona of just being a jerk, right? So with that, we are now are today in the world of product design saying, look, if you want to be an individual contributor, if you want to get your hands dirty and do the actual design work, you can do that. You don't have to move into people management in order to move up the ladder in your career.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we don't really have a crystal clear picture of what that role actually entails, right? Because it's still pretty new. We've had product design for a number of years now, and yet when you look around, the vast majority of people who have been doing product design for a long time in the digital space have moved on primarily to people management. And so it's kind of hard to look around and say, well, what does a really senior IC designer look like? However, we do have examples of this. And I think what we'd like to talk about now is kind of some of the misconceptions around those identities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Cool. So, I mean, you and I both talk about this often. I'm sure many people observe this as well. What is it when we think about a senior designer, a really senior person, let's talk about some of the cliches that we see around this, right? And I think we can readily come up with some examples. Do you want to start us off?
They're not always cliches, but I think going back to that sort of like independent, isolated designer, I think I guess maybe the archetype is what I'm looking at.
Right.
That person who needs space, who wants to go off, come up with a great idea, build the entire designs for it, maybe even prototype it. And this gets into sort of this like idea of unicorn slash celebrity type person who can do everything on their own because they're so skilled. And then they come back, they do a big reveal, they show this thing that we should be building. And maybe, you know, some are better than not. Some are just like sort of blue sky, visionary, amazing. And some are just like, you know, really grounded in data and could be useful. And then they come back, show that concept after maybe, you know, a month or two of design work. And then they get an engineering team and they lead that team to success. And then they get another promotion and everybody wants to be like them.
Yeah, that's great. I feel like we've both known quite a few people like that. When I was working at Facebook, I remember there were a few designers that I think they were great people, but their collaboration, their communication, their ability to mentor and help teach and guide other designers was pretty poor. There's one designer in particular that I really admired. And honestly, he did some of the best work I've ever seen. But his process was one in which he would just kind of vanish for weeks, sometimes months at a time, and then come out of the dark with this like really great prototype of like, here's what we could build. And it felt almost like magic where like he just somehow did this thing like on his own and suddenly it was amazing, incredible. And, you know, people would rally behind him. And then I started looking around at like the people around him and I realized like he's not helping anyone. He's just making things.
Yeah. And I mean, from Facebook, there's a couple examples and I'll give the product examples but not the people behind them. We did Facebook Home, which was like an immersive experience for the HTC One Android phone. There was Paper was another like beautifully done product that was like a Flipboard type experience. And another was like Slingshot, which is sort of like a back and forth photo, almost like a Snapchat kind of a personal direct Snapchat. And these were all like initially really they launched and they were really successful. And then little by little, each one got rolled back. And part of it was, you know, within this, the scope of Facebook's users or the people that use Facebook, they just didn't have the impact relative to what we would need to impact our business. And there, I mean, I think there's times where this actually makes sense. Like if your company is saying, or your leaders are saying, hey, we're actually going to send you off to do this. And it's like an innovation lab or, you know, something where it's like, go be creative. And that's what's, you know, that's what your mandate is, or your remit is, and you go off and do that. That's fantastic. But there's also times where there's the appetite to do that. And that's not the remit. The remit is actually something else. And one of the things I sort of look back on those experiences where, you know, a bunch of guys, and actually like literally like a bunch of white men were, you know, allowed to go off in these spaces or encouraged to go off in these spaces and come back with something like mind blowing. That was super, that was a great experience for them. And, you know, all of them have incredibly fruitful careers and have grown substantially. But then you look at the people around them and you say, hey, what could have been the alternate path? What if that wasn't the remit? What if it was, you know, hey, I actually want you to embed yourself on an existing team, even if it's not the most interesting thing in the world to you. And I want you to actually help lead and guide that team through your IC practitioner skills to be able to lead by example, to be able to push the boundaries of what could have been done in that space. And look at, you know, things like building relationships and collaborating with engineering and getting more invested in data and company strategy. Like I still kind of wonder, like, what if we would have put those folks towards those problems? Would we have caught some of the stuff that, you know, a lot of us are just a little bit unsettled with Facebook right now? Like, was there a better allocation of those? And I don't fault anybody for that, because I think it was sort of early times and we were figuring out what this IC path looked like. But this is one of those where I'm like, I don't think it's that way anymore. Like, I don't think that's what that senior path means. And the challenge is, I think a lot of folks who saw that, you know, the junior designers at the time when that person was like a super senior designer, I think they still aspire to that. And I think that's flawed.
Exactly. So how this usually plays out is designers, really at any stage of their career, but typically when they're just starting out, they see what this persona, this type of person, this very senior designer, what we can sometimes call like design celebrities, and they say, ooh, that's what I want to do. I'm going to go work like that. And so they go, they, you know, get assigned a project or they join a team or a company, and then they go off exactly like you described, and they say, like, I'm going to go work and do some magic and then come back and want to present this really stellar idea to my team. And that way people will think I'm great and I know everything. The problem, or one problem with that, is that we know through, you know, countless history, that when you take ideas and work and processes and put them in like a little private silo, they actually suffer. And why is that? Well, because the work that we do as designers inevitably has to come across other people, right?
Right.
We have users, we have teams, we have all these things going on. And so if you take an idea and you try to work in a silo, you're sheltering that idea. And it, when it finally like reaches the masses, it has to like stand up on its own.
Yeah.
And so my process that I always try to push on other designers is, you really need to inoculate your ideas. And the sooner you can do that, the sooner you can put an idea or a mock or a flow in front of somebody else, the sooner you can get feedback on where it might fall or fail or crack. And so if you can do that more often than not earlier in the process, you're actually giving your ideas a lot of strength. And so the only way you can really do that is by working on a team.
Yeah. And so the first example I gave, the first archetype, was sort of that, like, go off and be the new innovator, like the new creator of something new. I think there's a sub architect type of that, which is like, I'm going to do that within my team and within my divine space. So when you were talking, I was recalling another experience I had when I was working on the privacy team, and we were working on proactive privacy. How do we help our Facebook users understand the controls that they have in front of them and be able to proactively make changes to them? And the previous designer on the team had left me with like full on mocks of what the new privacy center should be. And I think this was a side project he had been working on. He was really excited to get it shipped, but had decided to move on to another team. And I looked at those and I was like, it was a clearly done, you know, in a box, in a silo. And, you know, some of the things that this just wouldn't work is, you know, when you look at users and how they perceive privacy, it's not just privacy, it's security. And security was a different team, and there was no incorporation of how security would incorporate with privacy. And so this, you know, one team, isolated designer working on something without talking to users, without talking to other teams, without, you know, really taking without taking a deep dive in the data, you know, that could have, I don't know how many hours he spent on that. It was a really like beautiful looking thing and probably something that you'd see in a portfolio and just go, wow, that's amazing. And without asking the right questions, you'd be like, yeah, this is amazing. But then, you know, just having to like drop that and be like, this isn't going anywhere. So it's still that same intent to create something, you know, to own something and to have a big reveal and to create something special and something new and something that has impact. But the process prevents that from happening. And that's true to both examples that I've shared. Well, I don't know if process was the thing in the sort of like unicorn space where I'm off creating the next big thing. That might just be the wrong environment for that to be in. Anyway, are there any other archetypes that you think of?
Not sure.
I guess another one that I would think of is like actually somebody who doesn't think they need to do the work anymore.
They've earned their seat.
It's like
I want to manage the project, but I don't want to.
I want to advise. Yeah. I want to consult. And I've seen that a little bit where it's like, once you've reached a certain level, like you've done the work, you've been in the trenches. And so now you want to just kind of like coach, you don't want to manage cause that's a lot of work, but you just want to like decision make. And you know, that sometimes means there's a track of work that needs somebody, but you just don't want to do that. You'd rather kind of rise above. And that's a hard one too, because, and this is probably true of all of these things. It's like when you are a company and you hire designers because you need them to do the design work. And, you know, there's many ways to do design work. Some is like getting more in strategic spaces. Some is getting into more executional spaces. And, you know, hopefully you're hiring around a range of that. The bigger your company is, the more you have flexibility to make space for extra things and extra roles. The smaller your company is, you really need to attend to the highest design needs before you make space for special roles. And so having, you know, folks who would prefer to not do the work on the team that's there. And this is an interesting one. And I had somebody not too long ago who ran into this, where it was like, she wasn't really motivated by the kind of work that we were doing. And so she wanted to work with a team that didn't need a designer. And in a perfect world, it'd be like, cool, you're good at this sort of systems thinking and that team could use systems thinking. But if it's at the cost of not staffing one of our core teams, I can't do that. And that's hard because sometimes that's more of a fit team or a fit thing where you're, you know, the thing that you want to do isn't what the company has to offer. And that actually might be something where it's like, oh, hey, this actually isn't a good fit with a company. And if you want to actually work on something that's more systems related, we might have to find, you know, another role for you elsewhere that does that. But I think that those are those kinds of like matchups where, especially the more senior you get, if you have an expectation to be removed from the core stuff and you want to play another role, that can actually be pretty destructive in terms of team makeup, because there's either that's perceived as ego or it's perceived as not wanting to be a team player. Or it's just, you know, sometimes there's just not a willingness to do the stuff that needs to be done.
Yeah, this reminds me of a very, very similar, almost identical kind of archetype, which is the designer who wants to reinvent the team or the company or the product, right? Mm. They come in and they're like, look, I see everything that's wrong with this company or this project. And I, as a designer, am a visionary and I can fix this. You know, I can come in and I can change all of this. And we see this in like the most peculiar ways, honestly. You know, I was talking to a friend recently who's a recruiter, and he said that he keeps getting this one applicant who is convinced that he can come and fix the company. So there's a few things wrong with that. First and foremost, this is an outside person who thinks they have any perspective of what's going on inside the company.
I'm laughing because I'm like relating so hard right now.
The second problem is you know, if you approach a recruiter and you're like, hey, your company sucks and I'm going to fix it, you're probably not going to get the job, right? Like, they probably not even want to have a conversation with you. And the reason for that is, again, like, you're on the outside, you really don't have any insight into what's going on in the business. What are their metrics? What have they tried? What are they testing? What's coming down their roadmap in a month, right? Like, you have no context. And so when a designer, especially, or really anyone, but, you know, for the sake of this conversation, designer comes into the conversation and says, like, because I'm a designer, because I'm an expert at solving problems, I can fix this. I can make this better, right? So you said this is like resonates for you.
Oh, yeah. It's just like in the applicants I've had, it's like, I will clearly talk about a role and the thing that we need. And they're like, your product sucks and I will come fix your product. And I'm like, no, that's not the space that we're asking you to work on. And P.S., like, if you actually knew what our customers are saying, it's not broken. You just think it's broken. Or, you know, you have to have data, and you have to like understand what's actually happening. And this is one of the reasons why we are not big fans of those sort of like unsolicited redesigns, is because you actually have to know what the customer problems are. You have to know what the business problems are. You have to know what's been tried before. You have to know the technical limitations in order to make those claims. And so somebody coming in and saying, yeah, just A, being offensive and saying, your stuff is broken and I will fix that. And I'm like, no, I actually need you to manage a team on this other side of the house. And tell me about your management skills anyways. like it just complete mismatches. But I think it comes from in some places, like, there's actually really good intent there. They see something that's broken that they want to fix, and they want to fix it. It's also very immature to just assume that you have enough information to hold that opinion that strongly. I would much rather have somebody come in and say, hey, I've experienced this, I haven't loved it, I'd love to learn more about it, and maybe there's a way I can help fix that. In the meantime, what do you need me to do? Not that we're not open to having people like uncover and take care of problems, but it's just a little immature and a little egocentric.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you're using the word immature, and I think you're right, but like the opposite, the more constructive approach to this is really having childlike wonder, right? Like,
yeah,
that's specifically what I think some of the best designers have, is they approach any situation, a problem, an opportunity, anything like that. And just instead of saying like, okay, I can fix this, like, I know I've done this before, I'm a pro. Instead, they say, okay, let's really figure out what's going on here. Let's try to uncover things. And so, like you said, just to repeat exactly what you said, if a participant comes, or a designer comes to a team or a company or a project with the intention of saying, look, this doesn't seem ideal, let's work together to figure out what is going on. And maybe it can be better, maybe it can't. That is a much more positive, constructive, and inclusive process, I think.
Yeah. And when you're, I mean, whether you're, you know, looking for a role or already inside, most companies have some sort of goals, company goals, like OKRs, which are objectives and key results, what you're going after, how you'll know when you achieve that. For all of these scenarios, when you have somebody who is, you know, a leader, an IC leader, they're typically your higher paid ICs, because, you know, they're further up on the leveling charts. And they're capable of taking on more, because in order to have gotten there, they've demonstrated impact and skills. And so the question is, you know, how are they going to be able to help meet those goals? And for some places it is like, yeah, let's start an innovation lab. Let's go off and see what we can do to be crazy and to innovate. And some of it is, hey, where are the places where our teams are hurting and need support? And those end up being some sort of like either horizontal or vertical focuses. Usually it's like, hey, is there a team or a group of teams that needs someone to come in and like oversee it all? Is there somebody who needs to work on collaboration between teams? Or is it just a single team thing where they need some like sharpening of their strategy or sharpening of their approach, or do they need to work on a few skills? Or is it that as the super senior person, you actually need to get in the weeds and show them how it's done from start to finish? Or is there just frankly a big hole where a designer needs to be? And so I think from my perspective, that's one of the hardest things that these beyond senior designers have to take on, is that generally it can require a lot of flexibility. And that's really effing hard. Like, it's really hard to be able to context switch that much, to be able to build relationships where you jump in and sort of like do the work that saves the day, particularly when there's senior designers there who are expecting to do that and you need to come and support them. And I think that's a far cry from this expectation of going off in a room and like creating the next iPhone or whatever that is.
That's a great segue into what I want to talk about next, which is these heroic profiles or personas of design heroes, right? The two examples that come most readily to my mind are Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive, right?
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about like Elon Musk or something.
Is Elon Musk considered a designer?
He's not a designer, but it's just that same sort of like, I don't know, genius.
Yeah.
Egotistical genius.
So, I mean, with the two examples of Apple's Steve Jobs and formerly Johnny Ive, you know, when externally, the way that we perceive these individuals is that they are doing exactly what you just described, where they go off, they do some magic, they come back, they instruct people exactly what to do, and suddenly, like, boom, we have the iPhone. But we know when we actually hear people who have worked with these individuals that that's not at all the case, mm-hmm. right? They do come often with strong visions. They have really strong opinions, but those opinions are often loosely held, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so people like Steve and Johnny, you know, they do have a lot of experience. They do have a lot of nice vision, but they're also very open to feedback, and they always take like the data first and foremost. So if someone comes to them and is like, hey, we need to work together on this thing, they're not just saying, well, here's what I think we should do. They're saying, okay, well, what are we looking at? How do we dive into this? What have you tried? How can we like partner together? How do we get research on those things? They're doing the opposite of what we often think they're doing, right? And this is like a really powerful force, I think, because if we're constantly telling the story in the industry that to be a really great designer or to be this great innovator, you have to like do it on your own, you know, that's not at all how this works. It's not the reality. We know this isn't the reality. In fact, you create weaker products and ideas as a result. So when we talk about like being this really senior designer, I think we need better examples in the world. We need better stories.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the thing I think about with the whole Apple crew is that because they have a culture of keeping everything internal, like everything is locked down at Apple, and these big reveals are headed by one person, you know, Tim Cook, Steve Jobs, like whoever's going to stand up and take credit for that. It's sort of... it just makes you think that there's no one behind that. And I mean, this is more recent times, but actually I think more recent times are relevant because we haven't had a Steve Jobs in a while. Or maybe I'm just not recollecting the closest person, but like nobody talks about celebrity designers beyond Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs. So yeah. But yeah, I think there's a culture that's created there. It's a culture of, it is an egotistical culture. It's a culture of, you know, hey, I did this, and yet there's hidden teammates behind this. Like none of this would be possible without teams. I think it's a little false, but I think it also sort of goes back to that first architect that we were talking about, which was probably inspired by Steve Jobs, that sort of go off and create the next best thing. I think we haven't had, maybe we've had more people who have done that, but very few successes around that.
Yeah, it's certainly possible to be fair. Like it is absolutely possible that someone somewhere can go off in a silo and do some magic and voila.
And why? I suppose the people who are doing this, it's like, go do your own startup then. Like if you want to innovate and change the world in a very specific way, those are the people that I think, you know, can go off and do that. And, you know, just maybe be less Elizabeth Holmesy when you're doing that. But I mean, there are people who are so passionate and so driven about changing the world that they'll form businesses around it. The good ones will be able to make something great of it. The terrible ones will make your lives miserable and you'll never want to work from, maybe they'll be a fake. I don't know.
Just so we're clear, who's Elizabeth Holmes?
Oh, she's the bad blood lady. She's the one who had this firm belief that she could, change the world by the amount of blood that was withdrawn to take blood samples, and it came from her fear of having blood drawn. And so she convinced all of Silicon Valley that she had the technology to do this, and it was all like smoke and mirrors.
This was Theranos?
Yeah, Theranos.
Man, it's so weird how similar it is to Thanos. Like for those Marvel fans.
Sorry for the loud laugh.
Well, that really went off the chart. We'll edit that out later. So, okay. So some real talk now. Okay. This is really hard for me because I grew up, trying to like pave my own way in the industry. I'm self-taught, as you know, I did not do well in school. I've struggled for a long time working in teams, and it's something I'm continuing to like try to get better at, my collaboration, my communication, things like that. For me personally, externally, I think a lot of people think that I am this persona. They think that I, you know, Tanner Christensen is this big.
Do you feel that way or do they feel that way?
So I think that is the outward perception. Mm-hmm. And I think there are absolutely things I do that probably can come across that way. But the way that I see my work and my career is really like, I just want to do good work. Like, that's all I want to do. Like, I don't care if anyone really knows my name or anything. The reason that I write, the reason that I do this podcast, the reason I share my work, the reason I do classes and kind of talks and get people together is not because I want to like become this persona. It's because I actually do want to help people. I want to see what I can help educate others on. And I think that is a critical difference between the previous things we just described, the archetypes, and people like myself, where, you know, yeah, I'm very loud, I'm very vocal, I'm active in the community. But that's not for my own egotistical reasons. It's because I really want to help people. And I think that's a critical difference where we talk about these designers who, again, go off in a silo and do their magic versus designers who are saying like, look, here's my process. It's completely transparent. Let's talk about it. What can you learn from it? What can I learn from you and your feedback? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think the thing I'd separate out here is like, you know, what is your goal? And for what it's worth, you and I have both passed the senior level at some point in our careers and been the elite type role. And now you're continuing down that path and I'm in the other path where I'm now leading and hiring these kinds of people, or working with them or coaching them, outside of work. I think there's a question to what is your goal? Like, why are you doing this? And if it's completely self-serving, like if the reasons that you write down when you answer this question are like, because I want to be the next XYZ or because I want to get recognition. I mean, because I want to learn is a better I statement, but I would sort of like watch and see like when you answer that question, are there things that are not involving you? Because I want my company to grow and be successful, because I want my team to be best in class, because I want to make it easier for my boss. There's intent there. And I think that can be very, very revealing, on the sort of like quality and integrity of your pursuit. And it's not to say like, we can't have personal career ambitions. I think when they sort of like all center around yourself, you're probably going to be hard to work with. The other thing that I was thinking through, which I'm losing, but it's going to come back to me, is sort of like, are the actions and is there inclusivity in what you do? Even if you are in a labs project and you go away, is there a way to bring the team along with you? Is there a way to get feedback? Is there a way for the team to understand what's coming, might be coming down and affecting their work? Or are there like really interesting innovation practices that you're trying that you want to share? So is there collaboration involved? Is there transparency? Is there good communication? Is there application of skills that you can share back? I think there's a question of, you know, how are you going about this? If you talk to other people, would they be excited about it for you? Would they say they're learning from you? Or would they be offended by you and feel like you're taking up space that somebody else could be taking up?
I really love your call to the importance of intentionality behind like everything we do. And this again goes back to a theme that we talk about all the time. I think we're going to continue to talk about because it really is just so important, and that is self-awareness.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're not really clear on your intentions, and this can happen, you can do things without being super in tune with why you're doing them. It's really helpful to go have conversations with other people, to do like some journaling, to maybe get a coach, which is another thing we talked about before, and really try to identify what your core why is. Like, why are you doing this and how are you doing this? And if you ever find that some of the feedback or some of your own thoughts are trending towards like, well, this is pretty selfish, this is just for the ego, then you can start taking action. And I think we've outlined a few examples of what you can specifically do to help kind of move away from that. But now let's kind of dive into for just a second what you get when you do the opposite of these things, right? So what do you actually see, and what are the results of being more transparent, being more collaborative, pulling people into your process? Like, what happens in those examples? Because we've talked a lot about like, you know, again, the Facebook phone and those kind of apps, and like how those kind of, they were very beautiful. They helped set some new standards for like interaction patterns, but ultimately they were huge failures, right? And the company lost a lot of money on those. What's the opposite of that? When you're an inclusive designer, when you're transparent, when you're a high level communicator, what is the product of that, would you say?
I'm not quite sure how to directly answer that, so I'm going to talk through it.
Yeah.
Whenever I look at different sorts of options, and here it could be like, should I go off and do my own thing or should I contribute? I always tend to look at like good for, like who is this good for, and do an evaluation on that. So like when I think about, you know, here, I've got a principal designer. I don't, so I'm just making this up. But I've got a principal designer on my team. I've got, you know, a project that they could be working on that directly attaches to our business goals, and they could have impact in that. Or they could go off and pursue this pet project that they wanted to pursue, and that would make them happy. And so I say, okay, which is what's good for the business. And in the, like when you're working on a core project, that's probably going to be really good for the business. We need your skills on that. Like you're probably going to be the best person to drive that. Business results would be great. Is you going off, in isolation good for the business? Well, there's like a 1% chance that maybe you'll come up with something amazing and, you know, that'll be better for the business. Not likely. So I'd say, you know, option A is good for the business. Good for the team would be another one that I'd look at. Hey, is it good for the team for you to be contributing, to be participating in daily critiques, to be modeling great work? Or are you doing this on your own and only surfacing in, you know, 30 days? Well, option A is still probably good for the team. What's good for you? Maybe you would argue that, you know, going off is better for you because it makes you happier. I could also argue that, you know, staying in and working with a team is good for you too, because it shows you a different kind of leadership and it allows you to flex some skills that maybe you haven't flexed yet. And so, and maybe I'll do like a good for me, like what's good for me as a leader. Maybe if you're running off, you know, and going into a cabin for 30 days, then I won't be able to check in on you. And so I'm accountable for your work. So that makes it a little bit harder for me. You're happy. That's also good for me. But then there's also like, I have one more project over here that I need to staff. So I would do that sort of evaluation and say like, hey, here's how we're looking at these things. I think there's something to like, if you absolutely hate the things that I'm offering you on this team and you need to go off and do those things, like obviously that's a whole different discussion on fit and things like that. But I don't know, that's just sort of what's going through my head right now.
No, that's great. I think you put that really well. It kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about inoculating your ideas. You could also need to kind of expose your processes and your thinking and your problem solving like abilities. Because again, the more outside perspectives you have, the stronger those things become, right? Like you only know what you know. You have a very small fixed view of the world. This is true for all of us. And when we work in a team, that view becomes a little bit wider. And we are exposed to more insights. We're exposed to more new and different processes or ways of thinking or understanding the problems in the work. And so if you're going off and doing things on your own, you're really just sheltering yourself from the opportunity to learn and do better work.
Yeah, I can see some folks in this role who would say, but I already know what the team knows. Like I'm a higher level than they are. I know how to do this better. And I think that's sort of a fallacy, because even if you may have done the design process 1,000 times, you haven't worked on every problem. And I've seen folks who have come in and with that sort of expertise, and it takes them a while to get ramped up, and it takes them a while to get to that level of high quality work. And it can sometimes actually expose the things that they have to work on too, which I think is great. Like, I think that's a great opportunity to continually evolve your tool set. And maybe while you're not like sort of extending the kind of work you're doing, you're really deepening your own tool set by working on more and more and more problems. And I think, you know, sometimes when we have folks who have like gotten promoted really quickly too, it depends on your tenure. Like if it took you 10, 15 years to get to like a principal level, that's different. Or it can be different than if it took you like 6. So figuring out like, what are the gaps that you still have to learn, and leaning into places where you're still building skills and experiences can be just as valuable as like trying to do something magical on the side.
It also goes back to what you were saying a minute ago about You know, it's not just good for you as an individual. It's very good for the team and the company when you're transparent and you involve others and you're a high collaborator and you're exposing kind of your process and your thinking and your work. Because if you really want to have influence in a company, you know, one thing is you need to build your relationships, obviously build trust and things, and being transparent and including others does that. But also, like, you really provide the opportunity for others on the team to also level up their thinking and be exposed to how you think, right?
Yep.
So as a senior designer, your role is not just the output, right? Anyone can produce output.
It's the influence.
It's really the influence. It's,
yep.
It's exposing your thinking, exposing your process. So even if you feel like, you know, I already know everything that they know, I've been doing this forever. Well, go prove that to them, like show them, and either you're going to be surprised or they're going to be surprised. And either way, the team as a unit becomes stronger.
Yeah. And when you think about influence, it's exactly what you just said. It's like we've all worked with people who come in and just tell you what to do. And you're like, come on, dude. Like, it can be egotistical. It can be too directive. It can be out of context. Sometimes it's fine. Or you can get somebody who comes in and says, hey, what are you working on? You know, tell me about it. Let's work on it together. The person who has the most influence is usually the person who can work side by side. And I know that's really hard, especially when you're on that IC career path, because especially if you've been working side by side for, like, you know, 5 to 10 years already, you're like, when do I get some clout? Like, when do I actually get to be able to be a decision maker and just have my word be respected? And that's particularly hard in companies that don't really share their titles explicitly. It's also hard when you go from company to company and you have to jump into a new company where no one knows you and you have to build up that reputation all over again. It's like, it's super, super exhausting. But over time, influence isn't just something you have to take. Influence is something that you have to earn. And that's sort of just the way it is.
So I want to end here by just pointing out that for many designers, especially just starting out designers, this can be really hard. It can be really scary to share your work. It can be really intimidating to ask for help or say that you want to pull in someone and hear the process. But again, like, if you're doing these things, it really is the best for everyone. And what you'll find is that people want to work with you more. They want to include you in the process. When they're having these really high level, very important vision workshops, they're going to want to pull you in more. They're not going to want to do that stuff if you're constantly pushing back, trying to prove that you know what you're doing, trying to, like, set yourself out as this, like, great visionary. No. They're not going to want any of that. And your work will suffer as a result.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it is hard. It can be very uncomfortable. I hear this all the time from designers I mentor. You just need to try to find ways to expose yourself, to slowly move into a more open and transparent position, because that will just help everybody.
Yep. Nailed it.
All right. I think that's it for this week.
Okay. See you later.